Okay, this is Gary Parrish again. It's the Eye on College Basketball podcast again, and I'm talking to you now on the morning of December 9th, otherwise known as the morning after. I spent a night in Oxford, Mississippi, watching Marshall Henderson come off the bench and get 39 points on 27 shots. That was a treat and interesting and all sorts of things, and we'll get to that here in a minute. Meantime, over the weekend, Kansas and Kentucky both lost. So did UCLA. Chaz Williams at UMass did something that hadn't been done in more than a decade, and we're now fully 1 month into the season. So let's get into it. Because it's Monday, my colleagues Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello are here on the podcast with me, as they are every Monday. Fellas, how are you on this Monday morning?
I'm doing well. Things
it's raining, so I'm not happy.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cold up here in the Northeast. It was
had an ice storm. Don't talk to me about cold.
And you guys probably have no clue how to handle it.
What do you mean, like how to handle it?
You don't have trucks to salt the streets and stuff like that.
Oh God, no, we don't have anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that. No, but here's the way we handle it. We don't go anywhere. We just we basically shut down. We just shut down, and everybody goes out and buys bread and milk. I go to the grocery store the other day during this ice storm, right? Because I don't know, I think I was out of coffee creamer, and I was going to pick up Chinese food, and I said, hey, I'll run in the grocery store real quick, and there's no eggs there. And so first off, we don't live in Antarctica, right? We live in Mississippi and Tennessee. So the idea that we've ever actually been trapped in our homes, it just isn't so. It's never happened. I'm 36 years old. I've lived around here my whole life. Nobody's ever been trapped in their homes to where you really, had this moment where you go, thank God we stocked up on milk and eggs. Otherwise, we'd starve to death. That's never happened to anybody, far as I know. Beyond that, why milk and eggs? Why not frozen pizzas?
Why not candy and soup or something? Soup, at least it'll last forever if your electricity goes out.
I think it's milk and eggs and butter, because those are the three fundamental things that you can make the most food with. I have no idea, but I'm with you guys. I don't get it.
They can go bad.
I just don't.
If your electricity goes out.
Yeah, I don't understand.
I know, I agree. When the electricity goes out and then you lose everything in the fridge.
Candy and soup.
No, none of this makes sense to me. So yesterday afternoon, I'm getting ready to drive to Oxford, Mississippi, which is about, 50 minutes from where I live. And I was worried, actually, about the weather. I was I don't know if I need to go. Am I going to hit, I'm suddenly terrified of nothing. It was literally nothing. If it normally takes me 50 minutes to get to Oxford, it took me 51 this time. So I get there, and honestly, I go down. I wanted to see Oregon, right? They're top 15 team in the country, and Joseph Young's they got interesting transfers, and it's a team I'd seen on television this year, but not in person. So I wanted to go see Oregon. I was planning on writing about Oregon, and more specifically, I was planning on not writing about Marshall Henderson, right? And then you go there, and he just he throws up 39, 27 shots, and it seems stupid that you're there and you're not writing about the guy that everybody is talking about. And I sort of made this point in the column. I'd be interested to get you guys' take on it. Can you think of another college basketball player in recent years who is neither a legitimate or serious NBA prospect? Because we pay attention to those guys, right? Whether it's a CJ McCollum or wherever. If you're a legitimate NBA prospect, we pay attention to you. Short of that, you usually got to be a relevant player on a nationally relevant team, or we won't pay it, or you're completely off the radar. And yet, this isn't just me. Yesterday, Marshall Henderson's playing on national television, and everybody who writes about college basketball is tweeting about Marshall Henderson. Can you guys remember, Norland, I'll ask you, another college basketball player who isn't a serious NBA prospect and isn't on a nationally ranked team who gets as much attention as Marshall Henderson gets?
I can't. Yeah, that's a good one. I don't think that there has been anyone like Henderson in that regard. And I thought it would be even more interesting this year, because with all of the quote unquote star power college basketball has relative to what it had last year, when Henderson was clearly the biggest star the sport had to offer, I was interested to see how bright he would burn, I guess, so to speak. I mean, we still don't really know what Ole Miss is going to be. I mean, we don't even know if they're going to matter in 3 weeks, but Henderson is still a story. By the way, did he start yesterday, GP?
Did not start. He's still coming off.
All right, so yeah, so he still isn't even starting.
He told me last night he's going to try to be the sixth man of the year.
Exactly.
Didn't he say his favorite players are like J.R. Smith and Jamal Crawford?
Yeah, which makes total sense, right?
It explains a ton.
You know, he hasn't been made available to the media all year long, really, since he was suspended back during the summer. And the Ole Miss officials let me compliment them. We're nice enough to make him available yesterday. And he was, I don't know if you guys have ever talked to him. He's just great. Like in that setting, like he's really, I'm not trying to sugarcoat any of the off the court stuff. Like he's a mess, right? He's an established mess of a young guy who's put himself in some really awkward and bad situations, and by extension put his university and his coaching staff in some really tough and awkward situations. But when you sit down across from him, he's one of the better, if not the best, interviews in college basketball. He really doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. He doesn't really shy away from anything. He'll sit there and actually have a conversation with you as opposed to just answer questions. I just find him to be a remarkably likable guy. Again, despite all of the stuff that's been well established about him, and I wonder if that trickles into. You know, you think on the surface, if you take 27 shots, your teammates are going to be frustrated with you. And Andy Kennedy at times seems frustrated with him, but his teammates never seem really frustrated with him at all. And I think some of it's rooted in the idea that they just like him. Like they just like he's a likable guy who, again, at this point is probably the front runner for National Sixth Man of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, I saw them in, I guess it was Brooklyn a couple of weeks ago, and he took a ton of shots and airballed some and missed a bunch. But, like, you're right. Nobody seems to, like, yell at him or be like, oh, pass the ball more or play defense more. No, it's just, like, they seem to like playing it, like, on the bench. They're joking around with him. I don't know. It seems like he's the favorite of everybody, even though he in another situation, he might be the most hated kid on the team.
He's like the in a much different way, but – you know, he's like the Richie Incognito of college basketball, where a lot of outsiders are like, what's with this guy? We hate him. But teammates seem to defend him at all costs and rally around him. I still think he's an interesting guy. I still think he is extremely valuable to them. But I'm not as much of a Marshall Henderson fan these days as I once was, just because I don't know. Like, I was in Brooklyn, too, the day before Borzello was, and he just kind of, like, this game wasn't on TV. He just kind of lost it for no reason at the end, started going after Georgia Tech players, like,
well, apparently he was, like, verbally. Pushed down. Like, there's somebody pushing to the floor.
It really wasn't that bad. He wasn't pushed down. He got bumped on a play. He went to the ground, and then he just kind of blew up. So he still got that fuse, which is probably what makes him so good and relentless. I mean, he tied a program record or set one with 10 three-pointers yesterday. A couple of them were absolutely ridiculous. But ultimately, I don't know. I do find it funny, GP, that he said he wants to be Sixth Man of the Year, which would be like one of the all-time more random trivia questions if he actually like continued to come off the bench and ended up winning it, because he would clearly – I mean, it'd be hard to negate that when a guy can put up what he did yesterday.
Yeah, and I don't know that he's going to keep coming off the bench. I think what happened is, you know, he had to miss the first, I guess it was two games of the season. And then just like anybody who sort of joins the team at a later date starts by coming off the bench. And then they were rolling. You know, they were winning. You know, they were undefeated before they went to Kansas State middle of last week. And so I think that it was just like, hey, why mess with it? This is working. But, you know, he played 39 minutes yesterday or something. Or I think it was 39 minutes. He actually started in the second half. So I don't know if he'll continue to come off the bench. But either way, he's just a fascinating player. He's fun to watch. That's it. I mean, I had some people – at this point, anytime you write about Marshall or tweet about Marshall, there's some pushback because people want to know, you know, why are you giving this kid attention? Listen, it ain't me giving this kid attention. I mean, I guess I did just write a 900-word column about him, but – The truth is, like, he's reached a point where he gets attention. What he does matters. What he does, people care about it. And frankly, you know, I think sometimes, and I haven't always approached this job this way. I haven't always thought in these terms. But I try to think of it more in these terms now. I listened to a podcast with our buddy Dan Wetzel, who's obviously a brilliant columnist, and he was talking about, you know, what his job really is. And I'm paraphrasing, but he essentially said, listen, you know, I can win these awards and people can tell me I'm really good at writing about this or really good about writing about that. He said, but at the end of the day, the reason I have a job, the you know, what my job is to bring as much traffic as I can to a website. That's it. Like, you can, everything else is secondary to that. Like, my job is to, the only reason I'm valuable to Yahoo Sports is that I can bring, theoretically, people to a website. And so when you start to think of your job like that, to go to Oxford, Mississippi and write about anything other than Marshall Henderson is a mistake. Because, right, like I could write about, you know, I could write about Mike Mosier or the job that Dana Altman's doing. And I did make a point to spend a few hundred words on that. But at the end of the day, you know, what is the story? What is going to make people read about a random Sunday afternoon basketball game? The reality is, yesterday, and this would be, I guess, my explanation for why I did what I did, is Marshall Henderson. He's the guy people will read about. Not everybody will read about Oregon or Dana or Joseph Young. Hell, I don't even know how many people know who Joseph Young is. But they'll read. People will read about Marshall Henderson. And so when people ask, you know, why are you writing about Marshall Henderson? Because you're reading about Marshall Henderson. That's the simplest answer I could give you.
I hear you, man. No, that's certainly on the money in the way a lot of writers think. And there's, you know, we don't have to get too inside baseball, but there's a very legitimate side to approaching stuff like that and still trying to maintain a balance of not just totally beating a dead horse. And with Henderson, at least there's still some newer angles and some perspective on him in this final year that we can still get some mileage out of, so to speak.
Speaking of things that people will read about no matter what, on Friday night we had a game between Baylor and Kentucky that got a late start because the women couldn't stop playing basketball. And it was like, I was like, come on, let's get the men's game, because it's like late, you know, on a Friday night. And you know, I was going to stay up and watch it no matter what, but like, get the game going already. And so I had some people going, hey, just sit back and enjoy this women's game. And I'm like, listen, you know, whatever. Okay. Like, it's a great women's basketball game. Like, you know, and you could put the best, you know, hockey game on, but it just didn't register with me because I don't care about the outcome. Like, you know, if you go to a Little League baseball game, it might be the best Little League baseball game in history or the worst Little League game. But if you're not emotionally invested in it or you don't care about the result, like, it doesn't matter to you. And so I found it difficult to enjoy I guess what some people were calling the best women's basketball game of whenever. I don't have any idea. But eventually we got to Baylor and Kentucky, the men versus the men. And Kentucky lost, and they didn't look very good. And then I spent Saturday afternoon watching Kansas do the same thing. While, and this is the point I made in a column, is that, you know, forget what we think, you know, Kansas is or Kentucky is or how they start, you know, in terms of personnel. The reality is four of their top five players on both of those teams are freshmen. And after we watch Kentucky now take two losses and Kansas now take two losses, I wonder if we have. And by we, I mean specifically me. I'm not alone in this, but I'm certainly, you know, one of the main ones who have overvalued what freshmen can be immediately. I think some of it is because what we saw Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Anthony Davis do, and so I think I've become of the opinion, although I'm trying to change, or I think I'm being forced into change, that if you take a group of really talented freshmen, put them together, you can go win a national championship, because we saw it happen just a couple of years ago. But are we learning, or maybe am I learning, and you guys already knew, I'll ask you, Borzello, are we learning that that's harder? You know, whether you're Bill Self, John Calipari, or anybody, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and Anthony Davis in that group, they made winning big look easier than it probably actually is.
Yeah, I think that the key is that team had veteran leadership, sure, already established on, like, Deron Lamb, Darius Miller, Terrence Jones, You know, those guys are already established. They knew their roles, and they could kind of guide the freshmen into, you know, kind of gradually get the freshmen going for that first month or two. But Kansas and Kentucky, you mentioned it, four of their five, you know, their best lineup is four freshmen and one veteran. And for Kansas, that veteran is, you know, Nadir Tharp or Perry Ellis. It's only a sophomore, yeah. And, you know, for Kentucky, it's another sophomore. It's Cauley Stein. So it's not like they have junior and senior leadership, guys that have been there, guys that have been through the wars for a couple of years. They don't have that yet. And I think that if they did have that, you know, maybe Kentucky only has one loss, maybe Kansas is undefeated. So I think that a team with four or five freshmen, it's going to take them longer than obviously a team with two plus veterans. So I think we're seeing that with Kansas and Kentucky.
I think Kentucky has losses to Michigan State and Baylor under weird conditions. So I think some of it is what GP's talking about. And the other part of it is Michigan State's a Final Four caliber team. And Baylor could end up being, again, I think they're actually due for the every other year making the Elite Eight. They looked pretty solid. And obviously Baylor winning gets lost in the shuffle whenever Kentucky loses, especially this early in the year. But, yeah, I think getting freshmen to play well early, elite freshmen specifically, when you've got so many of them clustered on a roster, you're usually bound to run into some issues. You know, between the two lost teams, Kansas and Kentucky, I mean, Kansas has lost two of its past three, but, you know, it lost on the road at a Colorado team that I think is going to easily make the NCAA tournament and lost at the buzzer on kind of a freaky shot. And then it lost against, its other loss was against Villanova, which is undefeated as of right now. But I do want to say, you know, that in between that, Kansas's win was against UTEP only by four, and they didn't look good. I think I'd rather be Kansas going forward of these two preseason Final Four contenders with two losses. But in the immediacy, I don't know. I think Kentucky looks better right now. I think they're the better team right now. Kansas tomorrow on Tuesday gets a road game at Florida.
Bill Self's going to regret this schedule at some point, right?
Yeah, right.
Like,
because I mean,
to take your team a young team to, it's one thing to go play Baylor in a 80,000 seat stadium, which is essentially
4,000 people there.
Yeah, well, yeah, like, yeah, it's another thing to go on other people's campuses, and you know, to play at Colorado on a Saturday, and then 3 days later be at Florida. I mean, that's one of those situations where even if you're good, you're probably underdogs in both games, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were
underdogs. They're playing New Mexico and Georgetown right after that.
Yeah, and then they, oh, by the way, the undefeated Toledo Rockets at the end of December. So,
and
I mean,
San Diego State.
Yeah, this is going to be, I mean, we could totally be in a situation where Kansas starts conference season on January 8th with four losses. Yeah, that seems probable, and that's not sky is falling kind of stuff. But when you look at that, and then we'll see how well the freshmen are playing. You know, Frank Mason will probably be the starting point guard by then. And by the way, I love watching him play. I love his moxie. I think he's really solid. But I just think it'll be inevitable that Kansas will have a second straight year where they're going to go into conference season and have some uncertainties at the point guard spot. That'll just make the issues around him a little more murky.
You said you would take Kansas over Kentucky the rest of the way, right?
I think big picture, yeah. If you're talking to me about who I think is more likely to reach the Final Four, I think I would take Kansas by a hair.
Why is that?
Because I think Wiggins will grow into be much more of an impact player. I love Embiid. Guys, he is, to me, like, it's not hyperbole what we're seeing said about him. I want to know the last time, I guess we had two players that were 1 and 2. Did Kentucky, I was thinking about this, I should have researched before the podcast, but did Kentucky, what was it? Was Kid Girl Christmas?
Yeah, they went 1 and 2.
Yeah, they won 2, but
it could happen again. Listen, I saw him work, like, I know Porzingis.
You were on this, GP. I remember the tweet. You said Wiggins is going to be awesome, but Embiid is something really special, too.
I saw him work out. And listen, you can't tell everything from a workout, but watching him, like, he's a legit 7-footer. Like, he's not one of those 6'10" kids that we call 7-footer. Like, he's legitimately like a big dude. And then everything he does is so fluid. Like, he doesn't look at all like somebody who's only been playing basketball 3 years. Like, and I'm not even talking about just the moves around the rim and scoring with either hand. Like, if you just give him a rack of balls 23 feet from the basket and say, hey, just shoot them. Like, he looks like a normal person shooting the ball. There's nothing awkward about it. And when I watched him work out, I was like, my God. Like, and at this point, let me just be completely transparent. I was already all in on Andrew Wiggins. It was too late to turn back, in terms of number one pick and player of the year and all that stuff. But I thought if they could get a second year out of Embiid, and I don't know that they can, that he would go one in 2015. That Wiggins would go one this year and in 2014, and then Embiid would go in 2015. But yeah, listen, I've had him since the preseason, third in my mock draft at CBSSports.com. So I wasn't like, whoa, my God, on Saturday, like a lot of people were. Like I've been on this for a little while. But he's terrific, and I do think some NBA franchise is going to have to seriously look at maybe taking him number one overall because he's a special talent.
Wouldn't that be something if he actually if he actually went ahead of Wiggins? But I was thinking about this. So to me, if they're pretty close, okay. Mm-hmm. To me, you take Wiggins because we just have too much history of big men failing at the pro level, most recently, most notably, I guess it's Odin. Is there a more recent example? But to me, like the Wiggins prototype is much more likely to succeed than Embiid. But I understand why GMs, when you see a 7'1", 7-footer guy that has pure natural offensive ability,
yeah.
And that's where Embiid, the notion of him gets twisted on his head because usually it's the other way around. The big men are usually ready defensively to enter in, but they're so raw offensively. With Embiid, it's weirdly the opposite. But to me, you go Wiggins because he just history shows a 6'7 player that's freaky athletic is much more likely to have a long-term successful career and immediate impact at the NBA level than the big man. Would you guys go with that as well, or do you take the chance on the 7-footer, which obviously they don't come every year?
Well, one interesting thing about Embiid is that when most guys have, you say that they've only been playing basketball for 3 years. And it's looked at as a positive. There's NBA people that look at like as a negative because those guys usually don't have a lot of feel for the game, and they're still raw. And like Embiid, his feel is tremendous. And I could see teams taking it, like if they can wait, if they don't need a guy. Like, I mean, I guess the team pick number one's going to need somebody to play right away. But I think Embiid's ceiling it could be absurd. And there's not that many great big guys in the NBA. And within 5 or 6 years in the NBA, he could be a top five center in pro basketball. I mean, I would still take Wiggins, but if a team can wait for Embiid to be a stud, why not him?
Oh, I would still take Wiggins, but I would seriously look at Embiid, and he might go second. It's funny. I was talking to an NBA guy about this the other day, and I was like, because you get into all these conversations, if any conversation about college basketball in this particular year eventually leads to a conversation about the freshmen, whether it's Jabari Parker, Andrew Wiggins, Joel Embiid, Julius Randle, Aaron Gordon. And the way an NBA person, and I don't think this is anything unique or exclusive to this particular franchise, but he said the way their franchise will look at this, if they were to pick number one, is that they'll take all these guys and they're just going to bet on the future. Like, they're not worried about who's great right now. In 5 years, whose ceiling is the highest? And the way he explained it, and these are the actual names that he used, he said, listen, Andrew Wiggins, if he becomes everything he can be, like if he turns out to be everything you hope, he can be Tracy McGrady, which is, a long wing who, scores big, great in transition. People forget how awesome Tracy McGrady was because he played on bad teams, but he was awesome. He said, okay, so there's your Wiggins comp. He said, with Jabari, you go, okay, if he's everything you want him to be, could he be Paul Pierce? Maybe. And then he said, with Embiid, if he's everything you want him to be, could he be – and nobody's predicting Hakeem Olajuwon.
Olajuwon, right, yeah.
But like, he's got a little bit of that, right? And then he said, okay, so then you get to Julius Randle, who everybody loves, everybody likes, whatever. He said, but like at Randle's best, what is he? He's like Zach Randolph, right? And Zach Randolph is terrific, but Zach Randolph's not Paul Pierce, and he's not Tracy McGrady, and he's not Elijah Wan. And so I think, though, Randall was the dominant force in college basketball early this year and will be all year long. He's going to be a dominant, physically overwhelming college basketball player. At least the NBA guys I'm talking to, they don't view him, Julius Randle, as a legitimate option for the number one overall pick. Is he a legitimate option for three or four or five? Of course. But a legitimate option for number one seems to be more from the group of Embiid, Wiggins, and Parker than I think Randall.
Yeah, just a quick thing. I think Jimmy Dykes was calling the game for ESPN, the Kansas-Colorado game, and he dropped the Embiid as the best offensive array of anyone I've seen in 25 years, something resembling Elijah Wan, and that's fine, and that would be awesome. But geez,
Embiid learned his post moves by watching videotapes of Elijah Wan. He taught himself.
That's great. But let's just like, can we? Oh,
no,
boy,
I just thought it was funny.
Like, I guess worry is the wrong word. But like, are we going to get to March and it's just going to become this de facto cliche that Embiid is the next Elijah Wan? I hope not, because that's obviously so unfair to the kid. Because Elijah Wan, like, to me, Elijah Wan's like one of the five worst NBA players of all time. Like, he was ridiculous. Like, nobody has ever been as good as Elijah Wan was.
If you go watch, I did this.
Oh my God. I could watch Elijah Wan videos on YouTube for 2 hours.
I did this after I was at that Kansas workout and I saw him. I was, you know, you're sitting in a hotel one night, you get up, you know, you end up on YouTube and then you're there for 2 hours. And honestly, the Kansas staff had said, you know, he's got some, they were yelling at him. He was working out by himself or with a manager or whatever. And, you know, I was sitting there with the Kansas staff and they were going, show us some of that dream shake. You know, they were goofing around with him, you know, playing around with him. But he like had a little bit of that. Right. And so I went back because, you know, when Elijah Wan played, I don't remember it. I probably hadn't seen Elijah Wan highlights in 10 years. And so I went back and started watching all these different he was unbelievable. Like, he was off the charts. Like, Elijah Wan, like, if not for Michael Jordan, like, Elijah Wan would be, you know, in the conversation for the best player of all time.
Right?
Like, he was. And so, look, it's obviously unfair to – it's unfair to compare any of these kids to any of these people. You know, Paul Pierce is like a 50-time All-Star. So, like, you know, it's always a – this is just sort of what we do, you know. I think when Jimmy – I don't want to speak for Jimmy, but I think when he says, you know, Elijah Wan and Embiid in the same sentence, I think, at least from my perspective, what that means is when you see – when you watch this, you see a little bit of that. I don't know that it actually means he's going to become that. At least that's not what it means for me, because that bar is really, really high.
I get you. Quick thing for you, GP. So I was looking at what teams have gone into, made it to a full month into the season without a loss, and we were talking about your top 25-1 before we came on. So Boise State is 8-0. Mm-hmm. You still don't have them ranked, but I just wanted to give listeners a look into your perspective here. Let's say Boise State beats Kentucky Tuesday on the road, which they probably won't, but let's just say they pull it out somehow. I mean, it wouldn't be totally unthinkable, even though it's unlikely. But then they lose on Saturday at home to St. Mary's, who is also undefeated. Would you then rank both of those teams if two teams ranked in your top 25 currently fell out? Or in your opinion, like someone like St. Mary's, who hasn't, you know, their best wins are Akron, Drake, and then if they beat a Boise State that beat Kentucky, is that kind of enough? How far do these smaller teams have to go into the season undefeated before they get serious consideration to be considered top 25 worthy?
I honestly don't even the first off, the simple answer is I have no idea. I mean, I'd have to look at it, right? I mean, obviously a Boise State win at Rupp Arena is going to get Boise State in. You know, one way or another, even if it means dropping Kentucky out, you know, it's going to get Boise State in one way or another. I don't think of it in terms of small teams. I know fans think that you do. Because I get these. The awful thing about ranking basketball teams every day is that you have to answer for it every single day. And a lot of times it's the same question, you know, like, you know, why is Wichita State here? Or why is Pittsburgh not there? Or, you know, why Ohio State in front of Syracuse? It's just the same. I saw Seth Davis late last night. He releases his AP ballot and on Twitter. And then people for the next 45 minutes just calling him an idiot over and over again. I deal with that every day, you know, like it's one thing to just have to deal with it on Sunday night and then you go watch Homeland and then you go to bed. I deal with it every single day. Like people constant. And a lot of times it's the exact same question from the exact same people, or it's the exact same question from different people who just weren't around yesterday when you actually explained it and so on and so forth. But I guess I say all that to say this, I don't think of it in terms of small schools or non-BCS schools or whatever. Like, you know, some guy, I don't know who he is, but he will consistently ask me about Wichita State, and I've got some BCS bias against Wichita State and whatever. Like, forget that, like, I'm actually, like, close with the Wichita State staff. Like, I was in Florida this summer and, like, spent time with the Wichita State staff because they just happened to be vacationing down there, too. Like, the idea that I'm biased against Wichita State is just insane to anybody who actually knows me. But yet people see all these things and they think it must be because you're against the non-BCS schools or the non-power conference schools or whatever. I strictly look at it from – I'm impressed by quality wins. Like I'm not impressed by 9-0 records. I'm impressed by 9-0 records where you have actual quality wins. Now, Wichita State does have some quality wins, and I'm not even talking about them specifically. But so when the question is phrased as, what do the small schools have to do? The truth is the same thing the big schools have to do. Like, you know, beat good teams, beat other good teams. That's the best way to make somebody like me pay attention to what you're doing. And I recognize there's a million different ways to rank basketball teams, and it's a subjective process by definition. But typically the most important thing to me is, particularly if you start outside of the rankings, is you've got to win your way in. And the way to win your way in, at least the best way, in my opinion, to win your way in, is to beat somebody who's already there, to show you're better than somebody else we've already got there. That's how Missouri gets in with a win over UCLA. It's how Iowa State got in with a win over Michigan and so on and so forth. So I'm actually looking forward to this Boise State-Kentucky game because, you know, Kentucky's problems are still, you know, they exist and they're obvious. I mean, it's obviously a talented team, but they're young and somewhat dysfunctional right now. Whereas Boise comes in, I mean, that's a veteran team that's won a lot of games. That's a scary game for John Calipari.
Borzello's. That's
I was going to say.
Those are your guys
at the Waffle House in April.
Yes,
that's. I'm on that bandwagon. I'm driving that thing.
No, I'm. Listen, I'm intrigued by Boise State. I think they're. I think that's a good basketball team. I don't know that they'll win it, Rupp, but they could. It wouldn't be surprising, and it'll be a total meltdown mode for Kentucky fans if they do. Let me ask you guys a question because I think it was Norlander brought up Baylor earlier in the podcast. Obviously, after they beat Kentucky the other night, they've also got a win over Colorado on a neutral. Their point guard situation, which was a question mark coming in, seems to be rock solid. You know, they got two bigs in Isaiah Austin and Corey Jefferson, who returned to school, and so that looks rock solid. And yet here's Baylor again, and so I ranked them in the top 10, I think, after Friday night's win, and immediately. And this is I guess I could have talked about this off of the podcast, but I'm just interested to get your thoughts on it because I think I'm going to write about this for tomorrow. Immediately, and this is unlike any other school in the country, after I rank Baylor in the top 10 or say anything positive about Baylor, you get these anti-Scott Drew remarks from people on Twitter. I had some guy say, well, you need to rank Baylor five spots lower than you otherwise would because of the Scott Drew factor. What does that mean? Why do you think that is? Why do you think people, and I'm not even talking about like, I don't even know who's Baylor. Like, let's say Texas fans hate Baylor. I'm not even talking about it's Texas fans. It's just like random people all over the country who seem to want to take shots at Baylor and specifically Scott, even though he has been a remarkably successful college basketball coach. Where do you think this comes from?
So, I mean, it's all reputation, and it's the fact that like he gets a ton of talent. Like he gets top notch recruiting classes every year. And people think that he's never won anything. Like, he made it to the Elite Eight a couple of years ago.
He's been to the Elite Eight twice in the past 3 years. Like, yeah, there's only, like I'm going to look, I need to, I'll look all this stuff up. I'm going to have all my ammunition that I need before I start writing. But, like, there's only, like, a handful of programs that have been to two Elite Eights in the past 3 years.
And then he plays his own defense, and he's got.
So does Jim Boeheim. So what's the problem?
I'm just saying.
I know.
Then you look at you look at guys like Quincy Miller and Perry Jones and Isaiah Austin, and they're perceived as soft, right. And people blame that also on Scott Drew. And so they're like, well, he plays his own defense. He recruits soft players. Blah 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 blah. And it all goes into this thing where he can't draw up a play or win games ever. It's nuts.
Except he does win games. I know. He wins a hell of a lot of games. And
yeah, look, since 08, hold on real quick, GP. Since 08, when they made their first tournament under Drew, who's been there since the 03-04 season, here are the win totals. 21, 24, 28, 18, 30, 23, and now 8-1 to start this year. So in a grand sense, yeah, no, it's completely crazy. But there is... a reputation.
No, it's a it's a reputation. But it's also become like a groupthink thing.
Correct. Like, that's exactly what I was going to say.
It's cool to say that schedule.
Right. He is the easy target these days, and that's more than a little unfair.
Here's what's interesting to me. People say he gets all these great players, and he does. Like that's how you know. But who are the pros? Who are the great NBA players that have come through baseball?
And so, but here's the thing: then the Drew haters.
So then it's got to cut both ways, right?
Yeah.
So okay. Right. So he gets
never
all these.
Them.
So he gets all these great players, but okay, fine. But they're not in the NBA. So where are they? Well, okay. So if you tell me the only reason he wins is because he gets great players, he can't coach. Well, the reality is he's winning a hell of a lot of games and going to Elite Eights without having a slew of NBA players. That suggests he can't. So you can't have it both ways. You can't call the players great if they never actually turn out to be great in the NBA or legitimate NBA deals. And I don't know. It just seems like people pick and choose what it is they want to focus on with him and that program in general without just acknowledging that he is working at a school that shouldn't be going to Elite Eights or anything close to Elite Eights, and yet they do. Like, if Brad Stevens goes to back-to-back Final Fours at Butler, we think he's a god. But if Scott Drew goes to back-to-back Elite Eights at Baylor, we think he's a bomb? Like, that doesn't make any sense to me.
First of all, that's got to be in the first graph when you write it. And two, you're so right, because Baylor, before Drew, four tournaments in basically, you know, 80 years worth of basketball,
yes.
Just the definition of irrelevant at the major conference level. You know, we're all aware of the disgrace the program went through shortly after the turn of the century.
A dude killed another dude.
Yeah, I mean, just like honestly, outside of Penn State, the worst thing in college athletics that I can think of. Like, seriously. And you could argue we're not going to get into this debate because really, no. But it might even be worse than Penn State when you consider just what the hell happened there. So for Drew to take this job from Valpo, which a lot of people thought he was just nuts to do to begin with, and to stay there and build it up like this, I mean, it's really kind of ridiculous that it's gotten to this point where he is consistently lampooned like this. By fans and, you know, to be honest, like by plenty of coaches, too. When we talked last summer and we did our critical coaches series, there were a lot of guys willing to talk out of school off the record about Drew and what he does and how he's perceived as a cheater.
Well, listen, because that's the elephant in the room, right? People go, oh, well, you know how he's getting those players. They went through an 18 and listen. I am not defending Scott Drew as a recruiter, as somebody who operates within the lines, any more than I would defend anybody. I am never going to be in the business of saying somebody, quote, does it the right way. I have no idea who does it the right way and who doesn't do it the right way. I assume that if you're getting great players while acknowledging the culture of summer basketball, that you're probably not doing it the right way, right? And I don't mean to paint with a broad brush, but I just assume if you get great players, you're probably operating in the gray area, right? So I'm not sitting here trying to pretend that everybody's wrong to suggest that Scott might be operating in the gray area. But why him as opposed to everybody else who gets players too? Like why is it, you know, people don't talk about Tom Crean that way or Jim Boeheim that way or Tom Izzo that way Fred Hoiberg that way on down the list, Steve Alford that way and so on and so forth. But why Scott specifically? I don't understand that. And beyond all that, you know, it's worth noting they did go through an 18-month investigation where basically nothing came of it. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it was basically nothing. Meantime, and I love Tom Izzo. I think everybody loves Tom Izzo. But, you know, he got suspended for a game because they hired, you know, some sort of a summer basketball figure to work at a camp in violation of NCAA rules. Like, that's a recruiting violation. Like, it, technically, you know, Tom Izzo has been through more than Scott Drew has in terms of, you know, violations in that regard, at least recently. And yet one guy is considered do it the right way guy, and the other guy is considered the biggest cheater in the sport when there is actually no tangible proof to suggest that it's true. I just think I don't know. I'm just fascinated by all this. And so you can tell I've been thinking about all this stuff most of the week and ever since Friday night when that game went final. Tell me if I'm off base here. You know how every morning when you turn on ESPN College Game Day, right, Saturday morning, and there's all these Nickelback signs, right? It's like Les Miles loves Nickelback, and that's considered an insult, or, you know, so-and-so's favorite, Nick Saban's favorite band is Nickelback, and whatever. Like, here's the thing. I don't own a Nickelback album. I know some of their songs just because, you know, when a band is that successful, you're going to hear some of their songs. I don't know that Nickelback is – listen, again, I'm not defending Nickelback. I don't have any, like, I don't have their albums.
Here's it might
my,
be.
No, you here's love Nickelback.
No,
just
here's my point.
It's fine.
Here's my point. Like, whatever. Although that, like, that everybody got a drug dealer on speed dial, like, that's a pretty catchy song. Like, whatever. But here's my point. Here's my point. It's a catchy little song. Hey, Norlander, you know the words to it, don't you?
I have no idea what you're talking about. I swear to God.
Oh, shut up. Portello.
I honestly, I don't know what that song
my
is.
My God, you guys are supposed to be the young ones on this thing.
All right, I don't know the whole song, man.
I have no idea where this is going.
Okay, here's where this is going.
If I heard it right now, I could probably sing along to it.
Here's where this is going. Here's where this is going. At some point, and I'm not sure where it happened, it became the cool thing to do to say that Nickelback sucks. It became like the cliche. Everybody does it, right? Like, who's the worst band in America?
It was Creed, and then it became Nickelback.
Right. And listen, I'm not defending Nickelback, but I know this. They can't possibly be the worst band in the world. Like, they just can't possibly be, even if I don't listen to them. They sell out arenas every time they play. They've sold like a 50 bazillion albums. Somebody likes Nickelback. And regardless of what you think of Nickelback, they are remarkably successful, you know, band, period. All right? New paragraph. And yet for some reason, if I were to tweet right now, who's the worst band in the world? The overwhelming majority of responses I'd get would be Nickelback. Now, why is that? Is it because Nickelback really is the worst band in the world? Or is it because people just now think it's cool or funny or in or smart or something to label Nickelback that way? I think it's the latter. And that brings me back to Scott. I think Scott Drew's Nickelback. That's okay, what I'm trying to tell you.
Exactly. So now you've actually really knocked down your argument quite a few pegs when you're comparing Scott Drew to Nickelback. We now have our podcast teaser for Twitter. but you're actually touching on like a pretty intricate sociological examination of groupthink, I believe. And
am I off base? Well,
nobody, you're not off base. Like,
nobody
for
wants to be the guy that says that Scott Drew is a great coach. Because the people are gonna just make fun of you for days,
right?
And so you're right. It's groupthink, and it's the need to sound smart and edgy.
It's just it'd be one thing if I saw like Texas fans tweeting about, but it's people. Like, I swear to God, there's a buddy of mine who's a writer. I don't want to say his name, but he covers a school who is not in Texas, is not in the Big 12, and has never played Baylor. This guy could not have possibly watch Baylor play five times ever. All right. I just could not have done it. And yet the other night he was tweeting jokes about Scott Drew. Now, why are you tweeting jokes about Scott? You don't even know Scott Drew. All right. You don't know. And beyond that, you're tweeting jokes after he just beat John Calipari for the second straight year. Like, what? So I couldn't help think about this. It's just like people tweeting jokes about Nickelback. I bet you 75% of the people who tweet Nickelback jokes have never listened to Nickelback. They just know that it's cool to tweet negative stuff about Nickelback, so they do. And I do think that we reached that point with Scott Drew. And do you think I can make a column make sense if I go into all this stuff?
I think so. But
I think so. You could blend it. You could blend it and with the Nickelback.
The difference is Nickelback actually, like, truly, totally. I mean, they suck, though. I mean, they're.
I'm not trying. Okay, I got it. Here, but that's not my point. My point isn't.
I know what you're saying. I know.
You know what the other one is? My point is that it has become the cool thing to do to say Nickelback sucks, regardless of whether Nickelback sucks or not, which I agree. Again, I don't own a Nickelback album, right? I think Nickelback. I'm not going to a Nickelback show. I like, whatever. But my point is, it's become cool. Cool for people who really don't know anything about anything to just say, hey, Nickelback sucks, ha 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 ha. And I think Scott Drew has reached that point where people are like, ah, Scott Drew can't coach. What do you mean he can't? What, like, what are you basing that on? Like, because he wins a hell of a lot of games, you know. I'm not even trying to, how about this, I'm not trying to defend Scott Drew as a coach. I don't get into those conversations. That's Norlander's specialty, ranking coaches on their ability to get on the whiteboard.
The whiteboard.
Yeah. But that's Norlander's deal. That's not my deal. I just look at a guy who's been remarkably successful in a historically bad job, successful to an unprecedented level, and the idea that he is somehow turned into the biggest joke in college basketball just doesn't – I can't make sense of that.
I can't either, but I do know we've exceeded our possible Nickelback mention quota by about 74.
Let me tell you how it works on the other side too. Here's how it works. Since we're on this conversation, Saved by the Bell.
Best show of all time.
Okay, you're proving my point. You are the person I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I hear.
Because it's not the best show of all time. It's not even a marginally interesting show.
What?
If it's on
television. What is marginally interesting? It's a terrific show.
If it's on television, you will, like, whenever it's, in fact, you could do a search, right? You could do a search right now for Saved by the Bell, and somebody's watching Saved by the Bell right now. And they're going, oh, LOL, Saved by the Bell's on. It's the episode where, first off, you never laughed out loud at Saved by the Bell. It's not that kind of show. Like, you laugh out loud at Curb Your Enthusiasm. You laugh out loud at maybe Veep.
What, are you too cool for Saved by the Bell?
I'm not too cool for Saved by the Bell. Here's my point. It's not. It became cool at some point to, just like it became cool at some point to say you hate Nickelback, it became cool at some point to say you like Saved by the Bell. And so everybody's just walking around screaming about how much they like Saved by the Bell, when the truth is, Saved by the Bell...
Where is this happening?
It's a completely... Where is this happening? I'm going to do a search right...
Where are people running around yelling?
Watch this. Watch this. I'm about to do a search right now. Saved by the Bell.
It's a good show. Shut up. I watched it when I was younger. I watch it now.
Okay, let me see, hold on. No, here's the thing. Are you doing a search on it?
No, I thought you were doing a search and nothing came up, so you're trying to...
No. I'm looking, I'm going through, it's just people right now just tweet. Okay, like, yeah, Saved by the Bell, smiley face, Saved by the Bell, it's just a bunch of that stuff, right? Here's my point. Saved by the Bell is not that good. If you put people on an island and showed them 50 television shows, and one of them was Saved by the Bell, it might rank, like, it would rank in the bottom half, all right?
And you're a hater.
There are a lot of people, if you ask them, what's your favorite TV show, they will say Saved by the Bell. And the reason is because they think it's cool to say Saved by the Bell.
Mine's King of Queens.
All right, well, that's terrible.
Well, hey.
He does have a point, because I brought up the Twitter search right here. We got Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and Saved by the Bell in the Morning is a must. And,
I saw that one, too.
Yeah. boy. Yeah.
So there's this dude Mario, right? He just tweeted
three episodes of Saved by the Bell with an emoji.
Yeah. So, like, he's fired up about waking up on a Monday morning and watching Saved by the Bell. Do you know how stupid that is? Do you know how stupid? And first, I hate the LOLs on Saved by the Bell. All right, Borzello, you like that show? Tell me one time you've ever actually literally laughed out loud at it.
I mean, I don't know.
I don't know.
There's probably some exchange at the diner where I laughed out loud.
What?
The Max. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what line. There's no memorable lines from it.
Oh, God. Really? The best show of all time? Does it have any memorable lines?
Okay, so real quick, like, we are really going down a rabbit hole.
King of Queens is my favorite show of
all time. All right, so GP, what are your thoughts on... Breaking Bad, which seems to have legitimate critical acclaim, but obviously became a situation, or even like The Wire, where people are calling those two shows the best two shows of all time.
Yes.
Where does it flow out of groupthink and into legitimacy?
I think those two things don't have to be mutually exclusive. In other words, the reason everybody says the Beatles are the best band of all time is because the Beatles are actually the best band of all time. Like they had they wrote the best songs and so on and so forth. So I think you have these instances where the reason everybody says something is actually because it's true. And so when people say, hey, Breaking Bad is great, I do think it became like the cool thing to do to say, hey, I'm watching Breaking Bad or whatever. But like Breaking Bad is like legitimately great. It's a it was a terrific show. The Wire, same type of deal. So I think The Wire and Breaking Bad were fall more into the category of like the Beatles. The reason everybody says the Beatles are great is because the Beatles are great. The reason everybody says Breaking Bad's great is because Breaking Bad was great. But the reason everybody says Saved by the Bell was great is because I still don't know, other than people think it's...
You're hating on a show with Kelly Kapowski, bro.
Yeah, that's the only... Like, Kelly Kapowski, that's an all-timer right
and
there.
And my girl who went on to be Striptease, right? Or what was her name?
Showgirls, right?
Showgirls, yeah.
Yeah, I know. This podcast turned more existential than we've ever been before. I kind of dig that.
I'm going to sit down to this afternoon and write an entire column about Saved by the Bell, Nickelback, and Scott Drew.
It's gonna flow. It's going to be good.
No joke. I'm going to tweet out that column like 8 times.
Hey, let me ask you the last thing before I let you go. And my God, we're going way long here.
15
but
minutes.
I like you got anything else to do besides go watch Saved by the Bell?
I'm missing Saved by the Bell. Yeah. Saved by the Bell and Fresh Prince and Boy Meets World are my go-tos in the morning.
Oh, Lord. All right. Here's what it's. So the season started November 8th. It's now December 9th. I mentioned at the top of this that we're now one full month into the season. Off the top of your head, Norlander first, what's the storyline of the season so far?
The freshman, if you're...
Is it still? Because I feel like that's drifted a little bit.
That's the thing that pops into my head. Off the top of my head, the freshmen are still the storyline. Yeah, I kind of don't want it to be, and it might not, but... That's the thing that pops to me, and I hope as we move toward Christmas and the new year, we get a few more interesting angles, because once the season ends, I mean, we're going to be talking about these freshmen ad nauseum. I think by the time the draft comes, we're going to be like, just get these guys on damn NBA teams already. But they've been so solid in keeping all these teams relevant, even in losses. Kansas and Kentucky remain relevant and interesting because of the talent around them and the expectations we build within. But now as we get into December, I think you get teams, while not nearly as sexy, but you get teams like Pittsburgh, Ohio State, Villanova, even Syracuse, Wisconsin. What do all those teams have in common? They're all undefeated still, and so we're going to see how good they are when they can eventually start entering, like, Ohio State's what? They're number 2 in KenPom. They're going to be top 2, top 3 in the rankings today, and they are not considered by anyone to be a national title contender at this point. I don't know when that comes or if it comes, but that kind of stuff is when – that's what I get interested in as we get into December. Who are we going to consider legitimate?
Outside of the freshmen, I think that we've maybe talked most about North Carolina, just because coming into the year was the whole PJ Harrison thing. Then they lost to Belmont, then they beat Louisville, then they lost to UAB, then they beat Michigan State. So they've been kind of a topic of conversation every week as one of the lead stories in the country. So, I mean, I would go with the freshman also, but maybe the team we've talked about most could be North Carolina.
I think that probably, you know, outside of the teams highlighted by the freshman, it's probably – I'm actually going to Chapel Hill this coming up weekend to see Kentucky and North Carolina. It's interesting you – I still think we got question marks about Ohio State because although they destroyed Marquette, I'm not sure how good Marquette is, you know? Mm-hmm. But like, I don't need to see any more from – I mean, obviously we're going to let the season play out, but I've seen enough from Syracuse already, and I think Arizona already, and probably Wisconsin already. Yeah. To, like, those teams are good, man. Like, those are legitimate title contenders. And, you know, Wisconsin's already – I think I saw saw this tweet yesterday. They have 5, and I know the RPI is mostly useless at, you know, on December 9th, and some would argue, most would argue, lots would argue, useless 12 months a year. But either way, it is a measuring tool. And Wisconsin is right now 5-0 against the RPI top 50, and no other school in the country has more than 2 top 50 wins. Like, yep. They're really operating at a high level.
Only 10-0 team, and the only team with 10 wins in the country right now too. Wisconsin, man, Bo Ryan, it's a bad man. They are again just ridiculous, and I mean, wouldn't it be something if they enter? They probably will. I mean, they probably will enter the Big Ten season undefeated. I just brought up their schedule: Milwaukee, Eastern Kentucky,
yeah,
Prairie
View,
and Northeastern.
Be like 16-0 heading into a game at Indiana.
That'll be interesting. That'll be there. I'm always fascinated by Wisconsin and what they do, but this year, and they got, you know, it's kind of an insult to past teams when they've had legitimate players and NBA prospects, but they've got legitimate players on this team, and they will certainly become a bigger story if they can, as Borzella says, get to mid-January without a loss.
All right, we have almost pushed the hour mark, so it's probably time to cut.
This has been longer than a Nickelback record, man.
hey, seriously, I'm not defending Nickelback. But like that drug dealing that speed dial drug dealing song.
If I heard this song, I'd probably know. I don't
know
it off the top of my head.
Look at this photograph.
Oh yeah, I know that one. I did hear what's my guy's name? Is his name Chad Kruger? Is that his name, Kruger?
It's Chad Kruger. You don't have to pretend not to know his name.
No,
everyone's
I was just trying to make sure I knew his name. I'm not trying to, dude. I've spent 20 minutes defending Nickelback. I'm not trying to do anything. But I heard, and he's married to Avril Lavigne, right? Did you know that?
I did not know. That's
random.
Avril Lavigne used to date the dude from The Hills.
Yeah, Brody. Like,
yeah.
She used to date Brody, and then something happened between her and Brody.
Well, Brody probably just getting other ones.
Probably.
The Us Weekly. Us Weekly. Ion Us Weekly.
So Brody was hooking it with Lauren Conrad again. I don't know.
Yep.
I actually have no idea whether that's true or not. But so now Avril is married to Chad. And I did hear them on Howard Stern, a month ago or so. And they were interesting. That's the end of that story. Nothing more than that. But they seemed somewhat interesting. They seemed sweet. They seemed to like each other and enjoy each other.
Didn't she marry somebody else too?
Yeah,
somebody
she married. From, yeah, some other band.
Some other band. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is her second marriage.
I think it was one of the guys from Saved by the Bell, right?
No way.
Oh,
are you kidding me?
Do a Google search. I mean, a Twitter search. Just at any time of the day, almost any time of the day, just randomly search, and there is always somebody on Twitter talking about how they are LOLing at Saved by the Bell. It's the most ridiculous thing ever. And I didn't know. I didn't realize, Borzella, you were one of those people.
It's a good show.
But I will give you this for hype and scandal. I appreciate you doing that.
Can we next week? Can we just like? We'll give a spoiler alert to listeners, but at the end of the podcast, can we like spend like 2 minutes talking about Homeland because the finale is next Sunday? So we'll.
Man, Brody, yeah. Listen, I'm all for focusing on Brody and Saul and.
Thank God Dana's not in it anymore.
And thank God Dana's not in anymore. But like, what happened to Jessica Brody? I miss Jessica Brody.
Well, let's.
Where's Mrs. Brody at? Can't we check
in?
Hey,
let's break it down next weekend because you know what? I got to figure she's going to factor into the finale in some way. Just
Mrs. Brody is.
I got to think at some point she's going to have some minor thing. I think we're going to get a little. She's going to get a little screen time.
What I can't imagine.
I don't
any
know.
Scenario.
I don't know how she's going to fit into it.
Yeah, how's she going to fit into the next week?
I can't picture it either. But you know,
then why did you say that?
Because you know what. The reality is actors have contracts and deals are factored in. With
Matt Norlander.
Ask me how, and I'm telling you how.
Expert Nick on Batman. Actor contracts. I love that you're breaking down actor contracts for us and how they work.
Spent 15 minutes breaking down Nickelback. I don't want to get any crap from you.
Norlander knows the ins and outs of Jessica Brody's contract with Showtime.
Regret ever breaking it up.
All right, let's go. Remember, you can subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball podcast on iTunes. You really should do that because you don't want to have to wait a minute longer than you actually have to be able to listen to our breakdowns of Nickelback, Saved by the Bell, and
Jessica Brody's contract.
And Jessica Brody's Jessica Brody. I love the way you did that. With like the reality is, actors have contracts.
Like, come on, real quick, like in 10 seconds. Like actors and TV shows and whatever, they basically say, okay, if I'm going to sign on to do this, it's why freaking Brody's still on the show because his agent said, no, you're not killing him off a show where he's winning Emmys. That's basically what happens. So they say, no, he's going to be in this many episodes and yada, yada, yada. It's just like a coach gets incentives for if I win this many games and so. That's all.
So what do you think? Tell me what it is you think Jessica Brody's contract looks like.
Listen, I don't know what it looks like. It could very well say, you know, this actress has to appear in this many episodes in a season and she might be contracted to be in 7 and she's only been in 6. So that means she'll somehow get written into the finale. That's all.
I'll bet you $100 right now. She's not in the finale.
can't bet that, but that's a good one. That's a good one.
Wow.
Bet me. And listen, I don't even want to win the bet because I want her in the finale. I want a Jessica Brody spinoff. Love Jessica Brody so much.
Hey, listen, real quick, Firefly. She's in Firefly.
What does that even mean?
Netflix. She plays a future space hooker in Firefly. That's all.
Whoa, a space hooker?
Space hooker?
That's a.
Why do you know so much about her? Contracts, space hookers.
I got Jessica Brody on lockdown. Man.
Hey, Scandal is serious, Borzello.
Have you caught up?
No, I'm midway through the second season, but I knocked. Tell me how safe this is. I knocked out one episode on my drive to Oxford last night, and knocked out another one on the drive back.
What?
I'm driving.
That's fine.
I'm driving them. It is. If you hold your phone right at the top of your steering wheel,
right. Yeah,
you're basically looking at the road anyway. It works.
I've done that with the NFL Red Zone. I kept it on my dashboard, my iPad.
Yeah, see, Norlander, you don't know.
Okay.
Stick to Hollywood contracts, Norlander.
All right, I'll see you guys.
I'll see you later. Bye.